Welcome to this special edition of Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this issue, we asked 8 clinical investigators to present real but de-identified cases from their practices which typify the challenges of management of high-risk localized disease, PSA-only relapse, and metastatic disease. To begin, Dr. Tom Keene presents a patient to Dr. Len Gamella and Dr. Michael Zalewski.
Is a 37-year-old accountant, married, wife is 35, has 2 children, walks in, was recently diagnosed about 4 weeks ago with a nodule on the right base of the prostate. He had some vague symptoms that he thought he shouldn't have, went to his primary care doc who checked a PSA. No reason, no family history.
The doc felt the nodule?
Doc thought there was something funny on the prostate, and his PSA was 37.
So it's the old-time diagnosis.
The old-time diagnosis. And when I felt the same thing, wow. I don't think it's outside the prostate, but there's a definite palpable lump which occupies about half of the right base.
Any family history?
No family history.
Any questions, comments up to this point?
Totally upset about
this.
This is just like, okay.
Obviously, you'd be extremely upset.
It's a 4+3, not a 3+4.
Okay. So, Len, what would you be thinking at this point?
Well, I mean, obviously he has to be staged and counseled, but I think that this is a very scary scenario, and I think that for a 37-year-old guy who's looking at, theoretically on paper, 40 more years of life, you want to be as aggressive as possible with him, and I think you need to think about a variety of protocols, particularly if you can get this man on a protocol.
Clinical trial.
You've got a clinical trial. I think this is something you got to think about for a man like this, if he's willing. A lot of patients are not willing.
What trials specifically? Well,
there's a couple cooking out there. The big one that everybody's looking at is the neoadjuvant CALGB trial that he would probably be a candidate for.
And what's involved there?
That's neoadjuvant taxotere and hormone therapy versus the hormone therapy along in a neoadjuvant setting.
Who's eligible?
Patients with high-risk disease who are otherwise candidates for radical prostatectomy.
So I'm assuming his workup was negative?
Everything so far has been negative. He's had a bone scan, needless to say. He's had a CT scan, and I'm setting him up for a prostacin scan, even though a lot of people don't agree with it. I do.
Mike, what do you think about this guy getting a prostacin scan, and what do you think about the situation in general?
Well, in general, for a prostacin, I think we all recognize that it does have its limitations in terms of sensitivity and specificity. Certainly, things are better if you can fuse that information as currently being done with CT scans.
Does that mean you do it or don't do it?
We generally don't do it, but we heavily rely upon endorectal coil MRIs and getting a lot more anatomic information about what's going on locally as well. I'd certainly be interested in this situation about the degree of extracapsular extension and seminal vesicle involvement, which you're not going to get from a plain old CT scan.
How reliable is the endorectal MRI?
Well, there are varying reports based on, I think, experiences from institutions. At least in our institution and in a number of other institutions, you get the specificity and sensitivity is close to 90%, in particular for seminal vesicle involvement. And so I agree with Dr. Gamella. I think we need to carefully stage the patient first and get an idea of how extensive the local disease is.
Yeah. In deference to Dr. Zalewski, and I know a lot of people do endorectal MRI, the problem with most endorectal MRI studies is they're done after the biopsy. There's a lot of artifact that's involved. And while they may be good for seminal vesicle disease, they're not particularly good for extraprostatic disease. And I think sometimes the nomograms may help more. So we actually abandoned and did some studies a few years ago on endorectal coil MRI and actually found that it doesn't really help us. It actually confuses the situation in some respects. For seminal vesicle invasion, it may be very good, but I think when it comes to other forms of extraprostatic disease, I don't think it's that helpful.
The point is well taken, but we are very careful about not taking these endorectal coil until you are 6 to 8 weeks out from a biopsy. So it's recognized you're going to get post-biopsy hemorrhage. It's going to cloud the picture a lot. But if you wait 6 to 8 weeks, at least our radiologists feel you're really getting good information about
and
the local status.
How do your surgeons feel about endorectal coil MRI and making decision on who they're going to operate on? Do they deny someone an operation because of an unsuspected MRI finding that maybe wasn't matched up by the clinical exam or what you might expect from a nomogram or something like that?
Good question. And in general, they're going to incorporate that information as part of their surgical technique in how wide or not they should be excising tissue, periprostatic tissue as well. So I don't know if they would abandon the case unless there's gross ECE and seminal vesicle involvement where they'll counsel the patient appropriately. And that's why I think it's important in this case.
So did this patient have an endorectal MRI?
No, he doesn't.
You don't? Do you do them?
We do sometimes, but you know, I will not base my decision on an endorectal MRI.
What about this issue of changing the way you do the surgery?
Well, I mean, he has a palpable nodule on that side. During the case, we're going to look very carefully. I've always been a believer, if the nerves come away easily, they come away easily. I tell every patient I go in, if I do not like the way your nodes are going, we're doing this operation to potentially save your life, not to spare your potency. If you want to spare your potency, choose something else. So you're going to have to make your decision. Leave me to make the final decision. I'll make every effort I can to spare the nerves.
So
but if I don't
you?
Like it, I'll
where
take
are you
it.
Right now with this man?
He's now making his decision.
So he hasn't made a decision yet.
Yeah.
And what are the options that you discuss with him or recommendations?
You know, he's 37 years of age. So I said exactly what Lenny said. I said, you potentially have 40 to 50 years of life to go. Now, I'm not sure there's any of our treatments are going to necessarily be able to cure you. I think we can control you. And control is probably the main name of the game in this situation.
Did he actually say to you, what's the chance that I'm going to be cured?
No, he didn't ask me that, but I mean, I told him.
If he did, what would you have said?
If you have disease outside the prostate into the seminal vesicle, it's unlikely we can cure you. And that's to be quite honest. I think certainly with surgery alone, our radiation alone, or any of the other options alone, it's not going to be a cure. It's going to demand a multimodality therapy. And that'll mean that if you do have a positive seminal vesicle, I would watch it very closely afterwards if the PSA nadir down to 0.04 or less. But if it starts to rise, then he's automatically going to, he will probably be in a trial. I would hope he'd be in the Taxotere trial that's going on with the hormones.
Are you participating in that study?
Yeah.
But we
recruit most patients.
Now, did you discuss this trial with a man?
Yes.
They would go at this point, correct?
Or this is an adjuvant study.
I thought you were talking about neoadjuvant.
There's two. There's a CLGB is neo. There's the CLGB, which is neoadjuvant.
Right.
And I think the one that you're talking about is an adjuvant trial.
Mike, you agree with surgery in this patient?
In this situation, to go right ahead with some neoadjuvant and adjuvant, I think that's Lenny's concern because of the high-risk nature of his disease to try to initiate other therapies sooner, I think is a reasonable suggestion. But I'm concerned with this person's quality of life and the potential of just using a local modality alone, at least attempt to make the cure. So I do think a local therapy alone would be initially the right way to go here. Given his young age, I would lean more towards surgery here rather than towards a radiation-based modality. I would agree that both of these approaches long-term probably would provide the patient with equal longevity outcomes. Some of the concerns regarding radiation in such a young age would be the slightly increased risk of secondary malignancies. So if the urologist is prepared to do the surgery and think that there's a reasonable chance of getting negative margins, I think that's the right way to go, and going at it alone and based on the pathology, recommendations can be made for any adjuvant therapies.
I would like to say, I mean, this guy is going to meet a medical oncologist and he's also going to meet a radiotherapist before.
When? Before?
Absolutely before, because I think he's going to meet them down the road anyway.
Hmm.
He has a high PSA, he has a Gleason 4 plus 3, and I don't believe necessarily, unless we get lucky, 20% of T3s. I don't know that he's a T3, but I suspect he could be a T3. 20% of those turned out to be clinical T2s on the Memorial series. But I honestly think he needs to all his options explained, and I think he should see a radiotherapist, and he should potentially see a medical oncologist now.
But, you know, to take your point further, I personally strongly believe that virtually every newly diagnosed prostate cancer patient who's a candidate for local therapy to see a radiation therapist, an oncologist, and a urologist. And if you've got higher risk disease, then you need to see a whole team, including an oncologist.
I tell most of my patients when they get a diagnosis of prostate cancer, it's a very dangerous thing because they're now a case. And that's something that we have to be very careful about.
And I think things have changed dramatically the last 10 or 15 years in prostate cancer, where the polarity which used to exist universally between radiation oncologists and urologic surgeons has basically begin to vanish and evaporate. It's not as a contentious area. We're all, as an example of your think tank, we're all kind of working together now, recognizing that this is no longer just a surgical disease or just a radiotherapy sensitive disease.
I have no
hesitation.
That's
a large group.
Certainly, I hear that when I interview investigators in radiation oncology and urology. I've been hearing that for years now, and I think that probably that's the message that's getting
But there was traced. A message just came out at ASCO, and it depends on whom you see as to what treatment you receive.
And that's why people need to be seen, I think, with prostate cancer in some type of multimodality setting right out of the gate. It's nice to see them together, but at least even if you can have adjacencies or sequential visits, but boy, to be there at the same time, I think, is the best you can do for a patient, because nobody knows the right thing to do for these patients. And at least if you present a balanced view and you can discuss it in front of the patients, we'll often go in with the radiation oncologist and the surgeon together and in front of the patient answer their questions together and tell them, look, we don't know this is the good thing or the bad thing about doing this.
But typically I have found the patients end up confused. There's a lot of patients out there who they come in with an idea, they go through all of this, they go on the internet, they talk to a couple of us, and they still end up very unsure at the end of the day. And that's
the nature of the reality, I think. But it doesn't take rocket science to understand the disparity. Our simple patterns of care studies, where we just randomly ask radiation oncologists and urologists, what would you do with a patient like this? You get very different answers. At this particular point, I was curious about how Tom worded what he might say to a patient about the chance for a cure. Could you put a number on it at this point?
What I would tell the patient, and Dr. Keene alluded to this earlier, that each step you take, you get more information.
So At this point,
I would tell this patient that more than likely he is going to deal with this for many years and that he's going to probably have to get involved with some long-term multimodality therapy.
Absolutely. With the high PSA and 4+3 disease, he's likely, with any modality, close to 40% to 50% likelihood for developing some kind of biochemical relapse or some clinical disease progression in the next 5 years.
So with that type of number, and of course, obviously you want to see what happens at surgery, but assuming he does have high-risk disease after surgery, I'm also curious, just to sort of end this discussion, whether you agree with Tom's strategy, which is clearly the dominant strategy that's used right now, would be to watch him until his PSA progresses, as opposed to treating so-called adjuvantly, which is right after surgery.
I think many would rely on and watch the patient's PSA initially, and if it nadir to a zero, keep a close eye on him. But you could make a very strong argument, given the high-risk nature here, depending upon some of the pathology findings. In particular, if this patient had a positive surgical margin, even though his PSA dropped to zero, it's very likely that he's going to be seeing these same physicians again for further counsel. So I probably, in the setting of a positive surgical margin, would treat him with adjuvant radiation.
What about hormones?
Probably so as well, but there's less data right now in this particular setting we can extract from, I think, various studies. Given his young age, I'm not too thrilled about throwing the hormonal therapy unless he relapsed or he had some actually palpable local relapse.